This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. So how does the criminal justice system engage your community? Well, that depends on your race. If you're speaking about drug crimes, FBI statistics show that blacks and minorities are disproportionately represented in the population arrested for drug crimes over the last three decades, even though drug use in general is evenly distributed in the population. In 2002, for example, in the 75 largest counties in the U.S., blacks accounted for more than 46% of drug arrests, even though they represented less than 16% of the population. Now consider that if your response to drug offenses is mandatory minimum sentences, then you create an engine for increasing the minority population in U.S. prisons. And that's what we've got in 2013. The Obama administration seems to believe that this is unsustainable and is signaling that change is coming. We're going to talk about that this hour. Also, a federal judge takes a look at a so-called preventive crime-fighting policy here in New York City, Stop and Frisk. The stopping and searching of millions of New Yorkers by the police suspected of no crime is a flagrant violation of the Constitution, says a judge. Trial evidence shows that policy has a huge impact on blacks and minorities. That's coming up. But let's take the federal piece of this first. Attorney General Eric Holder announced today that the administration is stepping away from mandatory minimum sentences for federal drug-related crimes.
Today, a vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, and incarceration traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. And many aspects of our criminal justice system may actually exacerbate these problems rather than alleviate them. It's clear as we come together today that too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for no truly good law enforcement reason.
And drug crimes qualifies as no truly good law enforcement reason, according to Holder today. The Justice Department will offer drug treatment programs for low-level offenders instead of jail time, early release for some current elderly inmates. That was announced today, who have served much of their time and have committed no violent offenses. There are many in corrections and law enforcement who have been waiting for some kind of change. One person with a personal sense of crisis about all this is Neil Franklin, former Maryland State Police officer at the Baltimore Police Department and an executive director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Neil says mandatory drug sentences have created a crisis in a number of ways.
Number one, we have prison overcrowding today. Just look at California. An overcrowded prison is a very dangerous prison, not just for the inmates, for those incarcerated, but for those correctional officers who have to work those tiers. It's a very violent society within those prisons. Gangs, as we know, were born in prison and they breed in prison, and they're very deadly. We have to get prisons back to a manageable level. Our goal should always be to decrease the number of people in prison. For law enforcement, these policies have created a huge divide between law enforcement and community. And for any law enforcement agency to be effective in solving violent crime within their communities, there has to be a very good relationship between the police and that community because we need their help. We need the citizens' help in solving crime.
If we maintain a tough-on-drugs sort of rhetorical stance, is it possible to reform? Because the political downside of being perceived as soft on drugs it seems to be a weakness for both Democrats and Republicans. It's a bipartisan kind of problem.
Well, first of all, any type of reform without drug policy reform, in my opinion, and in the opinion of the members of our international organization, is not nearly enough. It's just more rhetoric that we're going to be hearing. Drug policy is really key to this whole criminal justice problem that we have. So you're going to have to involve a significant piece of that if you're serious about criminal justice reform at any level.
Is there a consensus within law enforcement that certain aspects of drug enforcement needs to be decriminalized? Certain drugs, certain controlled substances need to be pushed away from the sort of felony zone?
The men and women working in the streets realize that this needs to take place, that we need to separate those who are causing the violence in our communities. We need to separate them from those who are addicted to these drugs where we have a health issue. There are two issues here. There are really two distinct issues here. And unfortunately, in the past, our government has combined these two. The first one is a health situation. We have people addicted to drugs. We have people using drugs who are addicted to drugs, no different than those who are addicted to alcohol. That needs to be dealt with from a health perspective. What we've done, we've combined that with the illicit trade. Now, we established policies that made drug use and drug selling illegal, so we created this issue. We created that problem. We always had one of drug abuse, but we created the one of drug prohibition, which has caused the violence that we have within our communities. And that's why we have so many shootings in cities like Chicago and Baltimore and Philadelphia and in New York, and other crimes as well, the robberies, those who are addicted and trying to get money to buy drugs from the illicit trade. They commit burglaries, they commit robberies. And we created that problem. We can make that go away, at least most of it, as we did with alcohol. When we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933, the homicide rate in this country plummeted. And then it rose again when we began the same thing over again with illicit drugs.
But you don't seriously consider that the administration is going to take prohibition as a policy option here when they're already opposed to the legalization that's taken place on marijuana in Colorado and Washington State.
If they were really serious about criminal justice reform, they would. There's no other way you can have a serious resolution to criminal justice reform unless you involve drug policy reform. It just doesn't happen. Rolling back mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, it's not going to do it. Let me put it this way. A few people will be sent home from prison, the nonviolent offenders, and we're talking about a very small number of people. Don't get me wrong, I'm very happy for these people. But at the end of the day, if you want to stop the thousands of people who are going into prison today, we still continue to arrest over 700,000 people every year just for marijuana possession. So if you're serious about people no longer going into our criminal justice system for nonviolent drug crimes, you've got to have massive drug policy reform. And that involves some form of legalization, regulation, and control for these drugs and get away from this nonsense of prohibition.
So you would be much more confident about a real change in policy, a real reform movement, if Eric Holder was standing up with Kathleen Sebelius on the public health side to talk about both aspects of this problem.
Absolutely. You know, to talk about this issue in its entirety. Then you would be getting really, really serious about addressing criminal justice reform in this country.
Neil Franklin, former Maryland State Police officer at the Baltimore Police Department and an executive director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, an organization of current and former police officers that work to redirect current drug policies. Neil, thanks so much.
John, thanks for having me.
Joining us now is Carl Hart, professor of psychology at Columbia University and a drug researcher. He's also the author of the book High Price: A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Carl, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
So it appears, either explicitly or not, a bit of an homage to your book, High Price, was something Holder specifically talked about as the failure of all of these policies, particularly drug policies. Your reaction to Eric Holder?
This is huge. In the past 25 years or so, we haven't had an attorney general to acknowledge the fact that these policies have had racist or racial discrimination sort of effects. The president also mentioned this about 3 weeks ago after the George Zimmerman trial. And so this is huge on the one hand. But on the other hand, I want people to temper their enthusiasm because there are some things that we could actually do better to address these issues as opposed to what has been laid out.
And let's hear one more remark from Eric Holder here. I gather, as he says this, your response should be something on the order of, yeah, it's about time. Listen.
As the so-called war on drugs enters its fifth decade, we need to ask whether it and the approaches that comprise it have been truly effective, and build on the administration's efforts led by the Office of National Drug Control Policy to usher in a new approach. And with an outsized, unnecessarily large prison population, we need to ensure that incarceration is used to punish, to deter, and to rehabilitate, but not merely to warehouse and to forget.
So it only takes us five decades to figure it out here? Is that your response to what Holder is saying?
Well, we've known this for a while, and now the president and the attorney general now has some energy, some support for changing things. So the thing that I want to point out is that there are some things that we can do to actually change that will make a difference. What has been laid out, it will make some difference, but it won't make much of a difference in those communities.
All that Holder can do unilaterally is basically change what prosecutors can charge offenders with. It's up to Congress to do anything else, and it's up to states and localities to change their laws.
You're absolutely right. And Holder has right now given us a way to say those various institutions, those domains that you talked about, Congress, the president, to use the bully pulpit and so forth to force change or to also advocate for more change. And there are a number of things that we can do. For example, he laid out that alternatives would be drug treatment. That's one of the things. The vast majority of people don't need drug treatment. So that's not the only way to go. We need to have some other alternatives.
Is there a public health dimension here where Holder needs to be relying on maybe someone at the DEA, someone at Health and Human Services to really take a look at this from another dimension?
One of the things that he did very well is he highlighted the limitations of the law enforcement approach. I think he's done that very well. One of the things that they need to do now is not only Holder, but the Congress and the president, they need to think about decriminalization, particularly when we think about marijuana. We can have a federal law that decriminalizes marijuana. 80% of the people who are arrested in this country for drugs are for possession. And those are the things that he talked about. Decriminalizing marijuana, which is the drug that people are most likely to be arrested for, will address all of these issues that they talked about.
Of course, Holder's on the way out. It's easy for him to talk about legacy, big ideas. Let's leave change as the legacy of my administration, of the president's administration. But as you know, the first young kid who prosecutors charge under the new guidelines a lighter offense than would normally been the case goes out and commits some violent crime and ends up in a political commercial and shoots down a candidate for president. We're back in the Willie Horton situation, right?
Back to Willie Horton again. But that's why I wrote High Price, so we could not be inoculated from those types of exaggerated aberrations. I mean, when we think about it, this is the 50-year anniversary to the March on Washington. You talked about legacy. If the president, if this Congress, if all of those people want to really do something about their legacy, they could actually do something by decriminalizing drugs.
Carl Hart, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Carl Hart is a professor of psychology at Columbia University and a drug researcher. He's also author of the book High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. And now let's get to that federal ruling on what has been deemed an effective crime-fighting strategy in the city of New York. Stop and frisk has been stopped by a judge. The policy of searching people on no apparent suspicion of a crime suddenly has some constitutional problems. Joining us now is Kathleen Horan, reporter for WNYC Radio. So this is a pretty significant ruling, and it comes directly at a policy that has been very, very popular among law enforcement in the city of New York. What did this trial attempt to examine, and what did we sort of see in the testimony?
Well, the plaintiffs alleged that the city was violating the 4th and 14th Amendments, you know, whether you can stop and search someone, and racial profiling, essentially. And the city said that actually stops are based on reasonable suspicion. They document their stops in these forms called UF-250s. They have policies in place. They have training in place. And they have a lot of oversight, is what they said. And in addition, you know, they've seen historic drops in crime on their watch. So what's wrong with that, they said?
The numbers say one thing, but the coverage of this policy and from the neighborhood level has produced a whole other level of controversy. Here is a secret recording that was done, and there's a number of these circulating. This is just one of what it's like to be stopped and frisked. Listen.
I just got stopped like 2 blocks ago, yo.
You look very suspicious.
Because y'all always looking at me crazy. Why you push me that for? Why you push me that for? Why you push
me that? Now that's a sense of a recording. It was part of a documentary. Someone named Alvin, who is a local teen, who recorded that himself, and that's from 2011. You've actually talked with people who have been frisked, stopped, for no apparent reason. And what kinds of things did they tell you about their reaction?
Well, officers will give them a reason sometimes. You know, you fit the description, furtive movements. I mean, they will always have a reason that they can give, but I think the person being stopped would question that.
And I think you get a sense of the vulnerability here. This is a 14-year-old that you spoke with. Let's listen.
They asked me, do we got any guns? We said no. They stopped us. They checked us. They put their hands in my pockets. They fell all over me, all types of stuff.
So that 14-year-old, Lamel Ryson from East New York, is important, first of all, for what he says. He certainly sounds pretty vulnerable in that situation. But he also comes from a place, statistically, that has a lot of these stop and frisks.
And the judge mentioned that in her ruling. She said increased contact with the police leads to increased opportunities for arrest, even when the reason for the arrest was not the reason for the stop. So the more contact you have with the police, the more you're going to be involved in the criminal justice system. And she also noted the human toll in her ruling, saying that each stop is demeaning and humiliating and that no one should live in fear of being stopped during the daily activities of life.
She also appears to have bought the argument that this constitutes a form of racial profiling and that this has a hugely disproportionate impact on African Americans and minorities in the city of New York.
Well, that's what the plaintiffs had to prove in the case, is that there is a pattern and practice and that it's beyond these 19 stops that were investigated or scrutinized during the trial. It's the whole universe of stops. And there's been about 4.5 million during the years this case looked at.
And the remedy here, and there are a number of remedies here, but the principal one is that a man by the name of Peter Zimroth, an attorney with a firm here in the city of New York, Arnold and Porter, will become the monitor for constitutional compliance for the NYPD. He has experience working in Manhattan as a corporation counsel. But what's the significance of that?
That was something that was expected if the judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. And it was something that the Department of Justice, you know, released a statement of interest on, saying that if constitutional violations are found, that we do recommend a court monitor because they ensure that any changes the court recommends, the judge recommends, are executed. So it is very important, but it's not shocking. It's just shocking that the largest police department in the country now has a federal monitor.
How does the federal monitor constrain the police in the sense that on the street they're going to behave differently? Because this trial was all about how the behavior on the street appeared to have been directed from very sort of specific recommendations from the high levels of the NYPD. What's the monitor going to do to change that?
He's going to ensure, ideally, that stops are constitutional and that there's new training, there's new documentation for every stop, and that the city, from the top on down, really makes it their business not only to keep people safe, but to not violate the Constitution.
Is this case appealable?
It will be appealed by the city. We expect that. There's an upcoming press conference by city officials. They have 30 days to appeal.
All right, reporting on the federal judge ruling today, really striking down the stop and frisk policy here in the city of New York, Kathleen Horan, a reporter for WNYC Radio. Thanks so much. Plenty of reaction to the judge's ruling on stop and frisk. On WNYC's Facebook page, Adam writes, "Really? Stopping and searching brown men with no probable cause violates their rights? Amazing." Ross Michael says, "Only took 10 years. We'd love your reaction to this ruling. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Weigh in and see a map of where various stop and frisks have taken place throughout New York City. Visit us at thetakeaway.org. So you may have caught the president's news conference on Friday. "I'm way ahead of the Edward Snowden leaks," he said in his first news conference since the NSA fiasco broke. "Way out ahead in reviewing and debating U.S. domestic surveillance policies," he told the world. And while he would not call Mr. Snowden a patriot, President Obama did say that NSA security officials are protecting us all.
"The men and women of our intelligence community work every single day to keep us safe because they love this country and believe in our values. They're patriots. And I believe that those who have lawfully raised their voices on behalf of privacy and civil liberties are also patriots who love our country and want it to live up to our highest ideals."
But perhaps the administration would rather have more of those patriotic men and women of our intelligence community written into software. A day before the president's news conference, NSA Director General Keith Alexander announced that his organization planned to reduce the number of systems administrators, a position previously held by leaker Edward Snowden, by up to 90% through automation. There are currently 1,000 system administrators working for the NSA. 900 of them become robots. With me is Noah Shachtman, foreign policy executive editor for News and fellow at the Brookings Institution. Noah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you turn 900 system administrators into robots, into software?
Myself, no, not personally. But the NSA might over time. It'll probably take 5-10 years. The idea is that the NSA, like the rest of the intelligence community, has a bunch of balkanized networks. Networks that grew up sort of organically, this little unit here, this other little unit there. And they need these system administrators to kind of tie it all together. And so the idea is if you sort of go to one consolidated network, that there might be a need for fewer of these guys.
All right. That basically just says you need less maintenance because the system isn't all patched together, as you're describing. But I'm wondering if there is a core technological question here regarding intelligence analysis of the scale of data that the NSA can see. Can you automate something like that?
That's a really good question. I think it's easier to automate now than it was 5 or 10 years ago, and it'll probably be easier still in another 5 or 10 years, but you're never going to do away with these guys. That's a bit of a fantasy. And that's why Alexander is proposing a 90% reduction, not 100% reduction.
All right. So, yes, obviously the mission here, and, we don't want to get too much into the mind of General Keith Alexander, but clearly there seems to be some sort of effort to prevent future leakers, future Snowdens, by narrowing the number of people who might become leakers, reducing the numbers. But I'm wondering if there's a technological sort of security concern in that you could launch investigations against people that were generated by word searches within software exclusively that could come up with sentences or bits of sentences that could go a long way down the road to actually getting people in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. You can't entirely trust this up to software. It's got to be a collaboration between algorithms and good old-fashioned flesh and blood creatures. I think the other thing just to note is that there's sort of this waxing and waning about how much information to share. That's something that happens over the course of years. So after 9/11, within the intelligence community, within the military, everybody was like, oh my God, we didn't share enough information. We've got to share everything. And now there's this sort of counter push after Manning and Snowden, like, oh my God, we're sharing too much information. Let's restrict things. Until the next big attack when everyone decides that we didn't share enough information in the first place.
There's another irony here as well. If you reduce to only about 100 systems administrators, each individual administrator suddenly carries a much higher value of data because it's more concentrated in those individuals. They have, in a sense, a greater incentive to leak.
Right, and they're greater targets for counterintelligence. Intelligence.
No, I wish you'd said, no, you're completely wrong there, John, but instead you said, right. See, I don't like that. That makes me very nervous.
I'm sorry, I'll never agree with you again, okay? Hey, look, the other thing is, it's not just these sysadmins that, have the ability to leak, right? And, the intelligence community employs tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands of more contractors, and each one of them is a potential leak target, okay? It's not just the sysadmins.
So ultimately, you view this as kind of a tweak.
I think this is part of an overall push that Alexander's been on for many years, long before Manning and long before Snowden, to gather up the intelligence community and the military's network into as much of a single pile as he can, and to have that information be lorded over by Keith Alexander or his successor. In many ways, Keith Alexander is kind of like a Google executive. He wants to touch as much information as possible in as many different places as possible and then be in charge of how that information is accessible or not to the military and intelligence communities.
Noah Shachtman is the executive editor for News at Foreign Policy and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Noah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Something big in a show business era we can barely recall now started with Edith Gormanzano getting together with Sidney Leibowitz.
You're walking along the street, you're at a party, or else you're alone, and then you suddenly dig. You're looking in someone's eyes, you suddenly realize that this could be the start of something big.
Sid and Edith became Steve and Edie, Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. Edie Gourmet died yesterday surrounded by her family in Las Vegas, the city where Steve and Edie performed so often and where they got married in 1957. She was famous as a crossover Latin American singer from the Tropicana days. Born of Sephardic Jews in the Bronx, fluent in Spanish and Ladino, she topped the charts with this one all by herself in 1963.
Blame it on the bossa nova.
She was known for her language ability long before she was a hit singer, and she never stopped being a hit on the Latin American charts. Steve Lawrence called her a diva to the Spanish world. One of her first jobs, in fact, was as a translator at the United Nations. The 1946 high school yearbook from William Howard Taft High School contains a picture of Edie as cheerleader Edith Gormanzano, a picture taken by budding cameraman and fellow student Stan Kubrick. Yes, that's Stanley Kubrick. Gourmet, not Kubrick, was voted prettiest, peppiest cheerleader that year.
What did I have that I don't have? What did he like that I lost track of?
Edie Gourmet had it for more than five decades. She was a character who retained her innocence as Hollywood and TV lost theirs. Steve and Edie were annual holiday show guests. They had their own show. Here in What's My Line, the TV show, Steve blindfolded has to guess the mystery guest, his wife, in the goofy, mushy comedy of those days.
Are you the mother of my children? No wonder you told me to get out of the house early tonight.
Or here on the Carol Burnett Show, completely comfortable as the celebrity next door.
Oh, Edie. Everybody knows all about it. I mean, it's in this magazine, the latest issue, Hollywood Rag. Edie spills the beans. Quote, when Steve started hitting the sauce, I threw in the towel.
Carol, that's a lie. You've got to read under the headline. Look at this. Edie Gourmet spilled a bowl of beans she was preparing when her husband, Steve Lawrence, was adding barbecue sauce to the recipe. Edie threw down
the biggie will start to spread.
Your fallen arches will drop like lead.
You'll find your beautiful smile has fled.
No hair atop of your shiny head.
Steve and Edie's many appearances on The Tonight Show and here on The Ed Sullivan Show were song-selling moments caught in a time warp of Broadway and movie musicals that not even rock and roll could change.
Sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the day.
Let's do a couple of songs you forgot to do.
Let's play cards.
Okay, good idea. Hey, let me get a little, you got a...
What do you want to do here?
Well, we got a couple of songs that you left out.
When Frank Sinatra was in his sunset years and did a 1991 world tour, he brought Steve Lawrence, looking very much like a Bill Clinton, and still peppy Edie along to back him up without stealing the show.
I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched.
Edie has been my partner on stage and in life for more than 55 years, Steve Lawrence said this weekend. I fell in love with her the first time I saw her, and even more the first time I heard her sing. Lawrence may have got to be Edie Gourmet's husband, but there was an awfully big crowd who fell in love the first time they heard her sing. Edie Gourmet was 84.
I'm not the girl who cared about love and
so after a week of warnings of imminent attacks and terror threats, this period of heightened vigilance has ended with a whimper around the world. All but one of the 19 U.S. embassies closed last week have now reopened. But the drone war over Yemen escalated significantly, and U.S. facilities there remain shuttered until further notice. Iona Craig is in the Yemeni capital of Sana'a, where she's been reporting for the Times of London. Welcome, Iona.
Hi, John.
Let's talk about what's happened in the last week or so. Is Yemen a war zone? And have U.S. actions destabilized the government there by projecting to the world that it doesn't have control over things?
I think a war zone would be something of an exaggeration. To be honest, here in Sana'a, nothing really changed last week. There was no visible sign of increased security, despite many reports. The thing that did change, obviously, was the surveillance planes that were hovering over the city for several days. But then after this terror alert was first instigated, we then saw this sort of huge increase in drone strikes here. We had three in the space of 3 days, and then that was followed up with another one late on Saturday night. So really, you know, the feeling here has been, at least, that this alert that was sent out by Washington in the first place is something of a pretext or almost an excuse to carry out all these drone strikes that we've seen in the last few days.
So it is a drone war, in a sense. What's the impact on the civilian population?
I think there's an increasing feeling of animosity about all of this, not only because of the issue of civilian casualties, and local reports suggest two of those killed last week were civilians and that three civilians were injured on Saturday night in the latest strike, but also the issue of sovereignty, about these bombing raids being carried out over Yemeni soil, and also the lack of transparency in the sense of who are the people they're targeting, what are they guilty of, and even once people have been killed, not knowing who they are, identities not being known, and even the government here not providing any clarity on who they're targeting or even why they're targeting them, which makes it very difficult for people to avoid these so-called militants if they're unaware that they're even being tracked or may possibly, you know, be targets of these drone strikes.
U.S. policy seems to be targeting al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I'm wondering what the Yemeni government line is there on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Are they an enemy of the United States, an enemy of the Yemeni government, or an enemy of the Saudis next door?
Well, they're an enemy of all of those. Certainly the Yemeni government here views them as an enemy, and so do the people of Yemen. There isn't a wide support at all for al-Qaeda here. So you have to remember there was a huge suicide bombing here in the middle of Sana'a last year when al-Qaeda killed around 100 soldiers. And that was, you know, that was felt by the population here in Sana'a very strongly. And there's certainly no support here for al-Qaeda in that respect, and they are seen as an enemy. But I think there are issues that affect Yemenis to a much greater extent than al-Qaeda. Most of them are struggling on a day-to-day basis just to provide food for their families, to access clean, fresh water, electricity, many of those basic services that you would expect from the government, such as schools, hospitals. Millions of Yemenis don't have access to here, and I think that's much more of a pressing issue for them than al-Qaeda.
What's the status of the U.S. Embassy at this point?
Well, the U.S. Embassy, as we know, has been closed since last week now, and they're staying closed, although they're opening all the other embassies that were shut down over this terror alert. So they're down to a sort of skeleton staff here, and the only other embassy that's remaining closed is the British Embassy, who evacuated all of their staff from Sana'a, and there's no real sign of when they both may open or their staff will return as yet.
Reporting from Sana'a for the Times of London, Ayona Craig, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hollywood loves the bloody greed inspired by sparkling crystals that look as good in the ground as they do on the necks of queens, heiresses, and hip-hop stars.
For 5 years, this country has reported almost no diamond exports, while Liberia, right next door, has exported $2 billion worth. Very odd, considering that Liberia has no diamonds to speak of.
I'm shocked.
Now, Vandekat denies trading in blood diamonds, but admits it's nearly impossible to tell where a diamond comes from, unless their smuggler gets caught.
That's a scene from the 2006 film Blood Diamond with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Connelly. There is no movie Blood Tungsten, but you could replace every diamond with a lump of tungsten and still have the same story of death and corruption in places where demand for tungsten in electronic devices has destabilized places throughout the world. According to an investigation by Bloomberg Markets magazine, a major tungsten mine in a remote part of Colombia is controlled by the insurgent guerrillas, the FARC. the FARC uses the proceeds from the sale of the precious metal to fund its activities under horrific conditions for workers. I talked to Michael Smith, Bloomberg Markets Latin American reporter, who wants people to understand that a few grams of tungsten in a hot new smartphone often means life or death for workers in Colombia.
Tungsten is one of the many sort of rare metals, if you will, that are present in minute quantities in all the gadgets that we use, and also in other products like your car, the pen that you write with. It's a metal that's used in very specific applications, but is critical for all those things to work.
And as the global industrial economy grows, demand for something like tungsten suddenly puts it in a category where it's not unlike a conflict diamond, where the commodity is so valued that a lot of rules about politics and working conditions go out the window. Explain how that is the case here.
Well, there are rules, but it's very difficult for a company that really wants to follow them to make sure they're being followed. The issue is that with tungsten, which is a conflict mineral, just in Africa, it's one of the minerals that has fueled war for a long time there, along with diamonds and gold and tantalum and tin. Those are the conflict minerals. People that need tungsten, which, you know, are companies all over the world, are really scouring the globe, and that opens doors for unsavory suppliers like the FARC in Colombia.
Do the companies have any interest, as far as you could tell, in knowing where the tungsten came from, or is it much more a situation where they don't want to know, they want to look the other way?
Well, they say they do have an interest. You know, the big major companies like Apple, HP, car companies, BMW, Volkswagen, they all have very well thought out and well-funded anti-conflict minerals policies. But they haven't paid attention to other parts of the world by design. They're starting in Africa. Their goal, they say, is to eliminate conflict minerals worldwide. But they're not able to stop this from getting into their supply chain.
How easy is it to turn conflict tungsten into just regular old bars of tungsten that has no provenance, no indication of its origin?
Well, we found that it was quite easy because the critical flaw, if you will, is that in much of Colombia, the state, if you will, the democratically elected government that rules Colombia does not exist. So that makes it very easy for criminals to make it appear that the minerals that they are getting from an illegal source, which is a FARC-run mine, are coming from a legal mining title, if you will. It's very easy with a little bit of paperwork to just lie and say, this metal comes from this place, which is licensed by the Colombian government to produce this metal. The reason they can get away with that is because it's impossible for anyone to go and check and see whether it's true, because there's no one from the government who can make it to those territories to confirm these things.
So if I were to be working for the FARC rebels in Colombia at this particular mine, what kinds of working conditions could I expect to find?
Well, it's a very sort of rudimentary kind of mining that is fraught with dangers. I mean, you basically have people digging pits in the ground with no security systems of any kind that they don't provide on their own. These are very poor people. They're Indians in most cases. And they're digging a hole in the ground in very bad, sitting in pools of water all day long, panning for this precious metal, and then humping it out of the jungle over very precarious trails that are fraught with dangers like snakes and, you know, you can slip and fall down a cliff. And they're, you know, they basically are getting this stuff any way they can so that they can sell it. This is being done on Indian land that's been given to them and is being preserved for them to live their lives. They're like reservations. And you have basically an outside force that's basically coming in and taking control of the riches that are on their land by force. And there's no one to stop them from doing that. So the Indians are basically subjugated to whatever the FARC wants them to do. And so if they want to make a living tapping the natural wealths that are on their land, they've got to give a cut to the FARC. And that creates tremendous tension between the Indian communities and the FARC. And also creates sort of exacerbation that the state of Colombia, the legitimate government, is not there to protect them and to help them and to do what they say they're supposed to do.
Is it too lurid to say that the nice, shiny Apple computer or the sophisticated, sleek BMW automobile is prized and functions at the cost of the blood of Indians from Colombia?
Well, we can definitely say that these luxury cars are being, you know, have this metal sourced to this country in them in some level, because they were buying from the buyer who's buying all this illegal tungsten, if you will. In the case of the electronics industry, a lot of the tungsten that came out of this mine, it went into the big sort of pot of tungsten that is in turn feeding in, you know, in very diffuse manner, the electronics industry. It's going into microchips. It's going into the screens on your computer. It's going into your television screen. So, you know, there are little bits of this stuff everywhere. I mean, it's just remarkable how something that comes from an illegal place immediately gets, you know, dispersed across the world. My TV has a couple of particles of tungsten from that mine, but the whole supply chain is contaminated, and that's the important thing.
Michael Smith, the Bloomberg Markets Latin American reporter, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Smith's reporting prompted many of the companies he named to start investigations into their own supply chains. You can read his reporting in the latest issue of Bloomberg Markets Magazine. You parked your kids in front of the TV two generations ago, and you were told they would become idiots or get radiation poisoning from the cathode ray tubes.
I'm the ghost that's known as Casper. I want to be a friend to you.
Of an atom, it's adamant. His strength, his might, his speed, his fight.
There's no need to fear. Underdog is here.
The ads that went along with those Saturday morning cartoons in the 60s and 70s changed the toy industry, the cereal industry, and the shoe industry. And I'm just getting started here. They improved the TVs eventually and the TV shows so that you could park your kids in front of educational TV like Sesame Street and at least convince yourself that their minds were growing while their bodies were not glowing in the dark. Today, though, there are way more screens and way more programs like this app from Fisher-Price.
Bananas.
It perhaps sounds like a lost cause in our age, but the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood filed a complaint last week against Fisher-Price's Laugh and Learn apps and Open Solutions, a software developer. The advocacy group argues that screen play can even be harmful if it comes at the expense of human interaction with family and friends. Dr. Melissa Morganlander is an educational consultant and curriculum developer. She founded the blog IQ Journals, where she often talks about the tension of parents needing to park their kids while still wanting technology to urge kids down the path of being little geniuses.
Apps have a lot of catching up to do. TV's had quite a revolution with kids' TV. I also am a part of that Saturday morning generation, which really doesn't exist anymore. You know, now there's no such thing. There's 24-hour kids networks. There's DVRs. That doesn't exist. These days, if you're creating a TV show for kids, you're pretty much not just creating a TV show. You're already thinking about multiple screens and how you can create multiple screens for kids. So,
and multiple sort of communities,
right.
Social networking sites where they can experience the show and the narrative and possibly engage in commercial activity, but
right.
Certainly that's not the only thing going on.
Right, right. I think also, I mean, in that time since the Saturday morning days, it's evolved to the point where networks, people that create media for small children, we're talking about preschoolers, have really wisened up to the idea that their audience actually isn't the preschoolers, but the parents. And the parents are the ones that are buying the products, buying the apps, buying all the stuff that goes with the characters. And those parents, for the most part, are seeking educational products for their kids.
Is that a sign of the poor child's enslavement to the educational mission of the parent? Are these entertaining? Are these actually educational in the sense that they contribute to cognitive development? Or is it all just making a parent feel good about, again, parking their child in front of an iPad for 2 hours?
I mean, a little bit of both. Clearly, there is this sort of anxiety among parents. If I am going to give my kid, you know, park my kid in front of an iPad, I should make it educational. It shouldn't just be junk. So, you know, part of this brouhaha about apps is really about whether or not it's actually working. For me, I have twins, and my son has autism. He's 6 years old. He has autism. He's minimally verbal. And he engages with an iPad like nothing else. What I am a little worried about with him is he's discovered YouTube. And YouTube is sort of a scary place. It's a very scary place, let's put it that way. And I've put all the parental restrictions I can possibly put on YouTube on the iPad, but it still scares me.
Here's a statement from Fisher-Price. Our toy development process begins with extensive research by our internal team of early childhood development experts to create appropriate toys for the way children play, discover, and grow. 8 years of research, we have appropriately extended these well-researched play patterns into the digital space. Now, is that them saying we know how to ration the amount of commercial activity in the digital space? We're not selling anything in the digital space, or don't worry, it's us. You love Fisher-Price, so you'll go anywhere with us, right?
Yeah, I think they're trying to say the latter. And they definitely, I mean, just to support them, I know that Fisher-Price does do that kind of research with their toys. So what they are saying is that we're doing nothing harmful, and I sort of tend to agree with them.
Kids also want the cross-platform experience. My 3-year-old loves Thomas the Train that he can hold in his hand. He loves the movie that he can see on a computer, and he loves the experience, very different, that he can have on an iPad as well. And
right.
And he loves to go from platform to platform.
Right. Yeah, I know a lot of parents tell me things like, well, he's getting screen time, but at least it's in front of an iPad and it's interactive and he's not being a zombie in front of a TV. The people that make TV will try to explain to you very patiently that they're trying to make interactive kids' TV, that it's not passive when you're watching Dora, for example. They try to incorporate ways that you're talking back at the screen, that you're shouting out answers. Touch screens are like the ultimate thing, though. I do sort of agree that there is a little bit of a difference between screens, you know, that there is a difference between touchscreen interacting versus television interacting.
Higher quality in your view and in your experience?
Not necessarily, because apps aren't necessarily always higher quality than what you're seeing on the TV screen. It's really a huge playing field with both TV and apps. So, but it can be. It can lead to more interacting. All professionals, though, in the American Academy of Pediatrics says, not the children should not be viewing any screens under the age of 2.
In 5 years, do you think they'll still say that?
Yeah. I mean, things change radically. I don't know if the American Association of Pediatrics changes that radically. I think that there still is an understandable need for infants to be interacting with the real world.
Well, the velocity of all this change is sobering to contemplate, to be sure. Dr. Melissa Morgenlander, thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Morgenlander is an educational consultant and curriculum developer and founder of the blog IQ Journal. So are you a screen kid? Did your parents park you in front of some screen to distract you? What do you use now? We'd love your stories. You've been sharing all kinds of stories of whether you're a screen kid or innovative ways of distracting kids back in the day. Pete in Oakland, California told us, audiobooks from the library on Walkman players before I could read and real books when I could. It was the only way my parents survived road trips from Oklahoma to Maryland and back.
My name is Naomi. I'm calling from Yuma, Arizona. When I was a kid, my parents just got me into reading really, really early, and I've always loved it. And I don't know if it was on purpose so that they could have time to themselves and get what they needed to do done, but I don't ever even remember having to be told, you know, go make yourself scarce, go do this or that, because I always had my nose in a book and was doing my own thing.
All right. Reading, full of virtue there, but I love this one from Nantucket, Massachusetts. Mud hole. My father filled a small hole in our backyard with the hose and then set me in it to make mud pies. I'd stay there as long as there was mud. It was his trick for getting things done while mom was gone. My grandpa used to do that to me, actually. Northfield, Michigan. I grew up in the 60s and 70s with a single mom. She would send us outside in good weather, and we wouldn't be able to come home till dinner. We would ride our bikes to other kids' houses or the town about 20 miles away. We spent lots of time in the woods in bad weather and winter. She gave us craft kits or jobs that would take more than a day to finish. Who cleaned up the mess, I wonder? Oakland, California. I asked my mom what she used to distract me, and she said simply, bugs. So I'm not going to try that one at home, but we do have plenty of bugs, and they are distracting. On tomorrow's program, we'll talk about a federal judge ruling today that stop-and-frisk policies are unconstitutional. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.